you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale.
It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It's my pleasure to have Russ Winter back on the show. Of course, Russ is the proprietor of Winterwatch, which winterwatch.net. Russ, how are you doing?
Very good. Thanks for having me back.
Well, thanks.
I was hoping you'd pick up on this topic, by the way, because I think you have a lot to add to it.
Yeah, you sent me that piece. I immediately thought of its broader context.
Okay.
Although, I don't know how you can get a broader context, you know, than the Russian Revolution, World War II, and the Cold War, but...
Well, you did do an interview with Richard Spence a while back that I think people should go back and listen to if they're interested in this topic further. And starting at about 50 minutes, in fact, I was just listening to it again this morning, You guys cover the whole operation that we're going to get into, and the... But anyway, we'll continue on. So anyway, 50 minutes at that particular Spence show that you did is also very illustrative.
Yeah, that was his book on the Russian Revolution, and it's, of course, the financing of it, which was out of the banks of London and New York.
And I think what we're going to talk about actually connects some of the dots, and maybe connects some of the dots quite well.
So you had this piece on the Red Symphony, which was a... Sure, it's become an internet classic, and I think reported it's a transcript of an NKVD interrogation for the 1938 or during the 1938 Moscow show trials. The prisoner was one Christian Rakovsky of your name Rashauer. He was a Bulgarian official of the Comintern, and I think Rakovsky has been identified as sort of a Rothschild agent, and he provides an explanation for Karl Marx, Lenin, Trotsky, Hitler, and how these people were more or less puppets or installed by the powers that be, and sort of set the pattern for the 20th century with the Russian Revolution, the Second World War, and the Cold War. Apparently, there's a transcript found by a Spanish soldier during the Second World War, during the campaign in Russia, near was it Leningrad?
Right.
And then it was published in 1960 in Spanish language. It's been translated to English. But I'll let you take it from there.
They tape recorded this interview, and the physician that tape recorded is named Landowski. And he took the transcript and translated. They did an interview in French and translated it into Russian. And he took a copy of it. And like I said, it turned up during World War II. And the debunking of this thing has been kind of poor, which signals to me there's something here. To me, it's a really incredible document. I kind of think it's genuine in many respects, but they've tried to debunk it by using some of the language that he uses. He referred to the British Commonwealth, and people were claiming, well, there was no British Commonwealth, but really all you have to do is look it up in Wikipedia. They were using that term in 25, and there was a Treaty of Westminster where the British Commonwealth was used. in 31, and Rakowski was an ambassador to the UK. So,
well, couldn't that be necessarily a question of translation? I mean, if it goes from Russian to Spanish to English.
Yeah, there might be a little of that. Anyway, to facilitate the interrogation, he was slipped in probably some meth or speed to induce energy in a good mood. And Rakowski was described as an expert conversationalist. He had exact, elegant, even decorative speech. He was told, basically, give us the truth. The public's not going to see this, but this is for Stalin's ears. So we want to know what you know. We want to get your version of events, mostly for Stalin. So the prisoner, whose Jewish birth name was changed from Rockauer, like you said, he was a key official. He was a here's the list of his. He's first chairman of the Council of British Commissars of the Ukrainian SSR, ambassador to UK and France. A Trotskyite. He was not an ally of Stalin. He was probably executed at a in 1941 along with the what's called the Medvedev Forest Massacre for defeatist agitation. But he survived the Trotsky trials. So let's go into some of the interrogation. He explained with great insight just how and why international bankers were behind international communism. Now, that's something that you and Richard Spence got into in your conversation. He says he just noticed they're kind of one and the same. Well, that's pretty much what Rakowski said. He said that particularly with Trotskyite communism, the bankers made moves to counter the Stalinist communist nationalism. They thought Stalin was too much of a nationalist. And so the Jewish financiers were promoting real communism, not Stalin's Bonapartism. That's what Rakowski said. So the general tenor of his remarks is that usury capitalism and terroristic communism are both tools of the same forces and serving the same purpose and masters, to wit, the financier is just as international as the communist. Both, with the help of differing pretexts and differing means, struggle with the national bourgeois state and deny it. There's clear similarities individually between communist internationalist and financial cosmopolitan. So I think that this really pulls together our world, understanding our world quite well.
It suggests the controlled dialectic that's been hinted at by many researchers throughout the recent history. I mean, one thinks you think of Carol Quigley and his Tragedy and Hope book about international finance, the world system, talking about the controlled left and right, throw the bums out strategy, these things. But this doesn't just apply to elections and domestic politics. It can apply internationally to controlling dialectics in various countries to achieve a further objective. For way down the road, I mean, a good example is Russia. I'm reminded of Anthony Sutton's research regarding the Bolshevik Revolution,
right?
And his exposure that the support that the Bolsheviks got at key moments by capitalist bankers, and it can't just be written off as something it's sort of something the expediency of the First World War, because both sides did it. I mean, you could see why perhaps Germany would send Lenin in a sealed train to undermine Russia so they could close off that front and shift 120 divisions west for Ludendorff's offensive. But how do you explain London securing Trotsky's passage and giving $10 million in gold bars to finance the revolution? That doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, and then Wiseman got Trotsky in, right, exactly. But the historical fact you have to also keep in mind is the Soviet Union stayed in the war until March of 2018. So some of this whole story about all the sealed trains and the transport of these revolutionaries is really strange. It doesn't really add up at all until you realize there are other hidden hands doing this stuff, kind of circumventing what's happening. And I've kind of developed an overall theory that I'm applying today in today's world. I call it the fifth column or the fifth columnist, that these people infiltrate, infest, they get in control. And when they need to steer events a certain direction, that's when they swing into action. They may just be quietly doing their ministerial jobs most of the time, but when the key moments arrive, they seem to always deliver in unexpected ways. And this is what Rakowski calls it. He says he talks about the real privilege of coining money for big affairs as representative of national wealth. Money, yes, money. It was being used by a few people about whom I had hinted. Banks, the stock exchange, and the whole world financial system is a gigantic machine for the purpose of bringing about unnatural scandals, end quote. And so he made it clear that the more well-known figures among financial internationalists, the bankers and politicians, are basically straw men, fronts. And then he was queried about who they are, and he offered up a list, but he said, I don't have my card index right now, and I'm not totally current, he said, because I'm in prison. Kind of one of the more humorous remarks. but he said, I have an intimate time reference for 1917. And he said, understand that they are not the state. So see, everybody's always thinking in terms of states all the time. They are which the international was before 1917. So he mentioned a few names. He mentioned Walter Rathenau, 1867, 1922, was assassinated by the right wingers for being that's the stab in the back guy.
Yeah, yeah. Right?
And he mentioned him specifically as what I call crime syndicates, which has been my term on all this, intermediary with both whom Trotsky and Rakowski had hands-on dealings. And Rathenau was Germany's Weimar foreign minister and a Jewish internationalist and the top Illuminatist. So then Rakowski says that after Rathenau, they kind of shifted back to using fronts rather than top kingpin. So Rathenau actually ranks real high, and he's the guy that got Lenin through Germany. When asked if Franklin D. Roosevelt was one of them, Rakowski replied, I don't know if he is one of them or is only subject to them. What more do you want? But I think that he was conscious of his mission. Others that he mentioned were Lionel Rothschild, the institutions of Bank Kuhn, Loeb & Company of Wall Street, and to this bank belong the families of Schiff, Warburg, Loeb, and Kuhn. I say families in order to point out several names, since they all are interconnected themselves by marriage. Then Baruch, Frankfurter, Altschul, Conan, Benjamin, Strauss, Steinhardt, Blum, Rosenman, Lippmann, Lehman, Dreyfus, Lamont, Rothschild, Lord, Mandel, Morgenthau, Ezenall, and Lasky. So some of those are big historical figures. A key turning points where key decisions are made about events.
That's interesting because in Russia, often it's written off the show trials as being Stalin being paranoid, and then imagining conspirators to undermine his dictatorship, his regime, and so he goes after these old Bolsheviks like Bukharin and Zinoviev and these, but it turns out there very well could have been a Trotskyite conspiracy to unseat Stalin, and that's what the evidence suggests here.
Well, Stalin knew that these guys were the top conspirators in the world.
Yeah,
so. It wasn't Stalin that brought about the Russian Revolution. It was this group, Rakowski and Trotsky.
Yeah, and it was also what's interesting is that it came in stages, because in the article he says that communism, the revolution, owes more to Kerensky than it does to Lenin.
Right.
Kerensky, of course, being the social democrat who ran the provisional government, who kind of cleared the way for the Bolsheviks to come to power. His sort of fecklessness and indecisiveness historically.
Well, Rakowski calls him a puppet under the total control of Trotsky. He was installed. He's a placeholder. Maybe kind of what Joe Biden's going to be. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's how I'm kind of processing it now. Joe Biden will be a placeholder for the next stage, which will be sort of the unexpected arrival of somebody maybe not so well politically known that's going to, I think, bring about the Cheka. That's kind of my prediction, in terms of the corollaries here.
Yeah, yeah.
So then Rakowski goes on about who's in charge, and he says that Marx and the highest chiefs of the First International, among them Herzen and Hein, were controlled by Baron Lionel Rothschild. So he thinks it's a Rothschildian operation. And all these people that I kind of mentioned before kind of come from this certain area of Germany, of, you know, North Baden and the Rhineland district, not too far from Frankfurt. And then we had that conversation, I think, a couple of years ago about the Sabbatean Frankists all that. And so I think the deep history is very familial. And, you know, like 29 of Rothschild's 58 grandchildren intermarried. It's just a really strange bunch of people tied by marriage and from a very small neck of the woods. And they just get their people in positions of power. You know, you could just go on and on. You could talk about John Jacob Astor coming out of Northern Baden and all of a sudden just goes to London, hardly even speaks English, and just miraculously arrives to the top of this giant fur trading enterprise. And he was, had no charm, no personality, and ends up being the treasurer of the Freemason and the Freemason Lodge in New York City. Just strange occurrences.
Sounds like Bill Gates, right?
Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, the more and more I research this stuff, it's just more and more I shake my head at what I call coinky dinks.
Yeah, you mentioned the Rothschilds. Of course, the Rothschilds, infamous, famous, or however you view them, as this banking family, which effectively had taken over the Bank of England in the 19th century. Documents have been subsequently unearthed that I forget if it was Lionel Rothschild or the Rothschild who was in charge of British intelligence during the Second World War has been identified as a Soviet agent. Now, I don't think he was a Soviet agent. I think what that reveals is that Rothschilds were manipulating and controlling the situation in Russia.
Right.
And so the connections there, the fact that he'd be playing both sides, have connection. He's supposedly the fifth man in the spy circle that was exposed, in the 1930s in England, and which eventually, with what's his name, in the 1960s.
Yeah, I mean, they're steering events. Exactly right. I don't think they have any
Kim Philby circle, that all that thing.
But they don't have any particular loyalty to any state or any loyalty to any country. They just have loyalty to their clan and their steering events in a certain way, which Rakowski referred to as war. And here's a quote. He calls it the cosmic punchline for understanding the grand design. And he says this: war is the ultimate method of how Satanists rule. Mm-hmm. He used that word.
Yeah, Satanist. Yeah, yeah.
Satanist.
And you had that piece recently about Satanism explaining that, what you mean by that term. It's
right.
Yeah.
Yes, it's not necessarily devil worship. That's not really what it is. It's basically a methodology of operating and pulling the wool over people's eyes.
No morality. You're obsessed with controlling the powers and principalities of this world, and it's what Jesus was tempted with. And so obviously there's a theological, spiritual. I think there's a spiritual dimension to it. But practically speaking, it's people who are just involved in realpolitik, psychological warfare. There's sort of, the psychopathic approach to politics, which we see all around us today. Yeah.
So anyway, Rakowski goes on page 26. He starts talking about Lionel Rothschild in this book. And he says that the revolutionary portrait was done by Disraeli in his book Königsby. Mm-hmm. The English prime minister who was his creature. He describes Königsby in the character of Sidonia. Mm-hmm. That's supposed to be Rothschild, a man who, according to the story, was a multimillionaire, knew and controlled spies, carbonari, Freemasons, secret Jews, gypsies, revolutionaries, etc. Marx avoided dealing, and they also pointed out that Marx avoided dealing with banking power in his writings. All seems so fantastic, he says. And he pointed out how everybody was just wiped out by these revolutions, the bourgeoisie, the farmer, anyone
engaged in productive commerce and trade, yeah, except for honest bankers. Trade, yeah.
Except for bankers.
Yes. Well, that goes back to the money power, Yeah.
He says, remember the phrase of the mother of the five Rothschild brothers, quote, if my sons want it, then there will be no war. This means that they were arbiters, the masters of peace and war, but not emperors. Are you capable of visualizing the fact of such cosmic importance? Is not war already a revolutionary function? War, the commune? Since that time, every war was a giant step towards revolution and communism. So these guys are picturing some kind of messianic grand world order with these narrow group of psychopaths ruling the roost. And those of us that sense this are really called kooks in this world. You know what I mean?
Well, yeah, I think it's in Coningsby where Disraeli says that the world is governed or ruled by personages that the public never knows or sees. And this is the 19th century, Disraeli is writing.
Yeah. So once again, we have people historically, of important historical characters writing books about what you people like you and I are affirming. Isn't that curious?
Yeah, there's account, I think Niall Ferguson, the economist, was talking about this. And he's talking about, he wrote a book about the Rothschilds. And this was a documentary I was watching. He was talking about the acquisition of the Suez Canal. And Benjamin Disraeli, the first Jewish, openly Jewish prime minister of Great Britain at the time, of course, he was an advocate of empire. What happened was the French company, I think, that had built the Suez Canal was going bankrupt, and Britain wanted to secure it and buy it, more or less buy the shares and take it over, which they eventually did. Because this was at the time that Britain was looking to extend its interest into the Middle East. And he couldn't get Parliament together to do this, which was what legally required in order to Britain to sort of create this parastatal, I guess, entity that would buy up the Suez Canal. So he goes to Rothschild for a loan. And Rothschild asks him, well, what do you offer as collateral? And he goes, the British state.
You're right.
So that kind
that's precisely what they want is collateral right there.
Yeah.
They've gotcha. Okay, Leon Trotsky himself and Rakovsky suggested that socialism and central banking is the bankster's favorite tool to increase government power because a socialist state requires massive centralization. When something is centralized and top heavy, it is easy to control if you can put your man at his head. Now, so this is done in, this is spoken of in the 1920s, 1930s. Mm-hmm. You know, now, instead of having a war, you can centralize power with what? COVID-1984.
Yeah, a crisis, an emergency. And then he talks, you mentioned earlier how through the banking power there would create all these crises, and you call them shitstorms.
Yes.
And we see that in at a micro level, at least relatively micro level, in one country, like what happened in Libya or in Syria recently, where these attempts or successes at regime change are creating mayhem and anarchy in these places, destroying the lives of millions of people. And now we see it being played out throughout the entire West, in Australia, throughout the whole Western world, Europe and the United States, is this the lockdown, the economic mayhem, the explosion in debt, you know.
Right. And little shitstorm seems to increase the debt. I mean, now they're arguing whether they should have another stimulus of $1 trillion to $3 trillion. I just can't stand to watch it stuff anymore. What the big debate is about.
Like, you can stimulate the economy through printing money or creating money. People have to go to work.
Borrowing the money and acting like the borrowing doesn't even exist. And then they facilitate it by bringing interest rates down to zero, which is not sustainable. It's pretty remarkable. So probably rather than... maybe the war theory has been kind of altered towards shitstorms. I mean, I don't know. Well, maybe hope that's the good news from their latest method.
Armies and all that are something that you don't see anymore. Like in the Second World War, those were phased out. I mean, then they were phased out in their dirty little wars during the Cold War, with Korea and Vietnam. And of course, those were big wars for the people who lived in those areas. Just as violent in many respects, but as far as clash of nations, because those wars, I think, successfully destroyed what remained of genuine sovereignty. I think that time you still had people in government that still may thought they were representing their people, and they were gradually marginalized. And you talk about that in your piece about how education changed, about your piece on the on the Rees Committee, how it was exposed, how education was being changed to promote internationalism, to change the whole right. attitude. And of course, the creation of the UN and these things, which again was donated by on Rockefeller property and was a Rockefeller Rothschild project. So,
yeah, so they're centering around this whole centralization of power internationally, mm-hmm. right? Not and trying to avoid these nationalistic wars. I mean, I think the idea of World War II was to discredit nationalistic wars.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, show that hey, that doesn't work, guys. Don't you can't be nationalist. And of course, nationalism is part of the answer to opposing all this stuff in reality. So anyway, I'm noting that Trotsky himself acknowledged the role of Freemasonry and Illuminism in his book *My Life: The Rise and Fall of a Dictator*, 1930. And he said on page 106 and 124, it was during that time. This is Trotsky. That I became interested in Freemasonry. Then he says, in the 18th century, Freemasonry became expressive of a militant policy of enlightenment, as in the case of the Illuminati, who were the forerunners of the revolution. On its left, it culminated in the Carbonari. Freemasons counted among their members both Louis XVI and Louis Guillotine, who invented the guillotine. In southern Germany, Freemasonry assumed an openly revolutionary character, whereas at the court of Catherine the Great, it was a monarch, a masquerade reflecting the aristocratic and bureaucratic hierarchy. A Freemason, Nikolov, was exiled to Siberia by a Freemason empress. And Trotsky tends to kind of ramble,
mm-hmm.
but you can clearly see he's aware of Taco Bell commercials for you normies out there. he said, I discontinued my work on Freemasonry to take up the study of Marxian economics. The work on Freemasonry, however, acted as sort of a test for these hypotheses. I think this influenced the whole course of my intellectual development. And then Trotsky goes on and tells of a British financier who gave him a large loan to be repaid after the overthrow of the Tsar. And Arsen Gulovich, who witnessed the Bolshevik Revolution firsthand, has identified both the name and the financier and the amount of the loan and said, I have been told that over 21 million rubles was spent by Lord Alfred Milner in financing the Russian Revolution. And so there's your...
That's the Rhodes Circle, yeah.
Yeah, there's your Wiseman Trotsky connection through Milner, who's a heavy hitter, and the whole Milner thing.
That was the kindergarten and all that, yeah.
Well, you know what those guys are? You know what I call them now? I call them the British warmonger pederast.
Mm-hmm.
They're British pederast warmongers. That's your British imperial power at that time. And it's just amazing how many of them are pederasts, homosexual pederasts. You're not necessarily in the Epstein model, interested in young girls, but boys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that I think Milner, of course, that ties to the Rhodes. And Rhodes himself was a Rothschild agent. And I think when Rhodes died, his estate, most of his estate went to the Rothschilds, a very needy family.
Right, but he also created the Rhodes Trust, which kind of financed these his friends, pederast friends. So it's just it's a really
and the Rhodes Scholarship too, which creates the intellectual milieu or justification for all these things, where this becomes the norm or the establishment view of things and how you train people to be agents for the system, because that you get the Rhodes Scholarship. Rhodes Scholar, and then once you get that, you got all the right credentials to rise up through the system.
Right, and you have these dedicated people to their cause that are in control all the way through, bringing us to the present era. There's nothing organic going on at all about Bill Clinton getting a Rhodes Scholar. Nothing organic mm-hmm. about it. These are made men.
Stroke Talbert, I think, was one, and yeah, they're all dedicated internationalists.
So anyway, Spence picks up on this in his book, and he kind of, and Rakowski also reveals the connection of Trotsky through his wife to Jewish elite international bankers. And the primary text on Trotsky and the Russian Revolution is well covered in Richard Spence's book, Wall Street and the Russian Revolution, 1905-1929. And I kind of put up a condensed post on this called Firebrand Bolshevik Leon Trotsky, Fully Backed by International Bankers and the Pederast British War Party. And per Rakowski, he says, quote, together with him, there arrives in Russia his wife, Savoa. Do you know who she is? She's associated with Zivotowski, linked with the bankers Warburg and partners and relatives of Jacob Schiff of that financial group, which, as I have said, also financed the revolution of 1905. Here's the reason why Trotsky, in one move, moves to the top of the revolutionary list. Exactly what Spence was describing in your interview. Mm-hmm. You get, you know, all of a sudden he's on a ship in Spain, going to New York in a first class cabin, and ends up in Russia. As far as Trotsky's ties to the world financial elite are concerned, they are well known long before the publication of Red Symphony. In 1919, the French government received from its informant in Washington a detailed report where Red Lions, Trotsky, New York banker sponsors were listed. It was noted that Trotsky established his connection with the financiers after his marriage to the daughter, Natalia Sadova, a banker, Abram Shivotovsky. Now, it's funny that Netflix had a series. You see the Trotsky series on Netflix?
No, I haven't seen it, but I heard about it.
Well, they go into this, and, you know, I think I'm pretty well informed on the characters of this thing, but they hit it so well. They make it just look like all of a sudden Trotsky shows up in Paris and kind of, you know, seduces or wins over the Savosky, Sadova, Natalia, who just so happens to be the daughter of a banker who's never mentioned as Jewish. You
know? Nothing more attractive than a penniless revolutionary.
Yeah, something like that. Just this old narrative. I mean, they kind of, I guess they had to deal with it in some way, but it just came across as ridiculous. So in Spence's book, he says, here we answer the question posed in the prologue. Who was Abraham Zivotowski and why was Trotsky so anxious to contact him? Zivotowski was the youngest of four brothers, all born in the Ukrainian river town of Kremchug. Their sister Anna married David Bronstein and became the mother of the future Leon Trotsky. Trotsky and Savosky were family, mishposha, and close family at that. In his autobiography, Trotsky makes various mentions of Uncle Abram. He provides a little context, but reading between the lines, it's just apparent that Abram made a vivid impression on his nephew.
Hmm.
He married his nephew's daughter.
So it's a cousin, second cousin.
Yeah, isn't that kind of, that's the Rothschildian model.
Yeah, that's an intermarriage, yeah.
So it's just totally papered over in the Trotsky deal on Netflix, but you know, what else is new in our world?
Yeah, why would, again, bankers finance a communist revolutionary, given, you know, if you accept the mainstream understanding or dialectic of these things, where they're supposedly opposed to communism, and communists opposed to capitalists, and who's more capitalist than a banker, really? That's capitalism, you know, defined, really, as an ism, the reign of capital and its manipulation. So, again, it gets into the Anthony Sutton thesis, whereas, again, at that time, they were looking to destabilize Russia for one reason or another, upend or overthrow the Tsar, you know, Orthodox Christian Tsar, who, that system was largely outside the Western control banking system at the time. And so they eyed Russia. Of course, you can't deny the fact a lot of the names you're mentioning are Jewish. And you have, of course, the ethnic animosity that the Jews have towards traditional Russia, Orthodox Russia, given their understanding of events there, which are controversial. You know, the pogroms, these things, those stories. And so a lot of those Jews who emigrated out of Russia in the 19th century carried with them these stories of pogroms and oppression. And so when they were in a position in the West to strike back at Russia, they did. And that's, of course, Jacob Schiff is a great example of that, who's also tied tightly into the Rothschilds. I think they even shared a house at one time.
Right.
So right. You have that angle there, where that continues to this day, the neoconservative war on Russia and Putin and the rhetoric. It's something that perdures, it reverberates to this very day, this animosity towards Orthodox traditional Russia.
Well, I mean, big debate, is it all about the war business and building up war stocks, mm-hmm. or is it all about some kind of revenge? And
you can satisfy multiple agendas.
The latter a little bit. I kind of lean towards the latter because that's where you bring in your pederast bunch. And I'm convinced they're it's a pretty broad statement. I'm convinced they're all pedos and pederast running the war business.
Well,
look at Lindsey Graham. What a squirrely guy he is.
Yes. Well, that's also the compromise, the compromised brownstone operation that, of course, which is being exposed with the Epstein case. And, the fact that he's been exposed as being tied to intelligence, as Acosta said. And the fact that there's no investigation into that angle, which is you'd open up a huge can of worms, is that this is how you compromise an entire system. You install a bunch of perverts and deviants. You have a kakistocracy, which is easily to manipulate. And we're seeing that played out today, I think. This is why you're not seeing any real political... Really, if you lived in a democratic or a system where there was a real competition, this whole thing with COVID-19 would have been a huge debate at the very least, but it was just almost like, well, it's lockstep, as a Rockefeller document called it. It was like turnkey totalitarianism.
And well, so, the other element that comes up in everything today is what I call double bind, Gregory Bateson's double bind theory. And I just shake my head. The choices that are given people are ridiculous. You know, you have a choice. Okay, so let's just take one example. You have a choice of letting the rioters and looters run amok. And the St. Floyd incident, after St. Floyd had his heart attack, you let them run amok without interference, or you bring in a bunch of triple canopy, Eric, what's his name? Eric, the triple canopy guy.
Talk about
Eric Prince. Yeah, bring in a bunch of Eric Prince guys to handle it. Well, that's a false choice.
Yeah, because we're the police.
Right. We're the police, or maybe local the authorities. National Guard, which is state, you know, or maybe Posse Comunitatis, which can be brought in by the sheriffs to protect their own communities. So you're always given these false choices, and the false choice of the mercenaries, the Eric Prince mercenaries, is basically devastation of the 10th Amendment and taking away the right for local control of your situation. We don't want that either.
Well, but this is where we get in the idea of cells or sleeper cells, if you will, being installed in these positions years before in anticipation of this very thing being implemented today is and you've covered in articles how the George Soros, who is another I think straw man that the system puts out to attract a lot of criticism, but nevertheless, his organization has been involved in funding a lot of local elections, sheriffs, DAs, mayors, what have you, to make sure that these leftist officials are installed at the time in Portland or in Philadelphia or in St. Louis or New York.
Yep.
You know, and now when the time comes for them to actually uphold the law, they act as sort of a checka, or they just stand down with mayhem spread.
Right, and then bring about bad choices, bad reactions of sending in these triple canopy guys to deal with situations. But let's go on and let's listen to what he said about the Russian Revolution, because it ties in beautifully with the last part of our conversation. So he says, Kerensky was to surrender the state fully to communism, and he does it. Trotsky has a chance in an unnoticed manner to occupy the whole state apparatus. And that's what I'm looking for now, an unnoticed manner. What a strange blindness. Well, that is the reality of the much-praised October Revolution. The Bolsheviks took that which they gave them. And the interrogator says, you dare say that Kerensky was a collaborator of Lenin? Of Lenin, no. Of Trotsky, yes. It is more correct to say a collaborator of them. Believe me, despite the statues in the mausoleums, communism is indebted to Kerensky much more than Lenin. Yes, to me, that is quite clear. Understand that I personally took part in all this. And he was in Stockholm. You know, you and Spence talked about Stockholm a lot as the conduit of the Russian Revolution. Mm-hmm. Well, that was that was Kerensky's, not Kerensky's, but... Rakovsky's central role. He was in Stockholm during handling this part of the operation. And then he says, do you know who financed the October Revolution? They financed it. In particular, those same bankers who financed Japan in 1905. And I have a little note here. It's just a sideline article. People want to read it. It's entitled UK Prime Minister David Cameron's great-grandfathers were Rothschild-connected bankers who financed the Russo-Japanese War. One of them was a British-Scottish guy banker, and the other one was Jewish. That's David Cameron's great-grandfathers. Mm-hmm. Isn't that a coinky-dink?
Yep, and this occurred in the 19th century where the Jewish bankers intermarried to the English aristocracy or establishment. And they loaned him a lot of money. This is how Churchill was compromised. The Churchill family was compromised.
Well, this is in 1905, and you mean to tell me David Cameron knows nothing about any of this? Just acts like, oh, well, you know. Okay, Jacob Schiff's in the Brothers Warburg. That means that through the great banking constellations, one of the five banks who were members of the Federal Reserve, through the bank Kuhn Loeb, took part also other American and European bankers such as Guggenheim, Hanauer, Breitog, Ashberg, the NEA, Banken of Stockholm. I was there by chance, there in Stockholm, and participated in the transmission of funds. Until Trotsky arrived, I was the only person who was an intermediary from the revolutionary side. Now, you guys got into the role of Parvus, mm-hmm. who ended up going, in Stockholm as well. So Parvus, I think, was kind of the direct link maybe to Rakowski and in turn to Trotsky. So those are the three operators that got Trotsky through, probably got Lenin through, and got the money in place. And he says, who arranged it? So that was interesting listening to you guys talk about Parvus. He doesn't mention Parvus. Rakowski doesn't mention him, but he seems like a central character, another bankster. Who arranged it? The same people who succeeded that Lenin passed through Germany. Yes, they were able to get the defeatist Trotsky out of a Canadian camp to England and send him on to Russia, giving him the chance to pass freely through Allied controls. Others of them, a certain Rathenau, accomplishes the journey of Lenin through the enemy Germany. If you will undertake a study, this is a classic right here, what he says. If you will undertake the study of the history of revolution and civil war without prejudices, and will use all your inquiring capabilities, which you know how to apply to things much less important and less obvious, then when you study informations in their totality and also study separate details right up to anecdotal happenings, you will meet with a whole series of amazing chances. That's the classic line.
Amazing chances?
Amazing chances, right.
Coincidence, yeah. No coincidences in politics, they say, yeah.
And then in my article, I have a scene from Fall of Eagles when they kind of pile on Kaiser Wilhelm. And remember, Kaiser Wilhelm had a big problem with the Lenin train and was kind of asking these ministers, what the heck are you doing here? Really? You want to send my cousin, Nikki, a bunch of revolutionaries? Why? Well, we want to knock them out of the war, and we're going to take 120 divisions and shift them over to the, you know. And he says, well, if it wasn't our military emergency that we're into right now, I would not sign off on this. And he kind of stomps out of the room.
Yeah, yeah. And he says, but you take full responsibility for it.
Right.
Whatever
right.
that means. You know, they never take responsibility for their actions, right?
Right.
And, so and there is Ludendorff marching with Hitler in the 20s, right?
Yeah, right.
Wasn't he at the Beer Hall Putsch in 1923 or something?
Well, I mean, Hitler was Ludendorff's guy initially. Yeah. From the time of his arrival in Petrograd, Trotsky was openly received by Lenin. As you sufficiently know sufficiently well, during the interval between the two revolutions, 1905 and 1917, there had been deep differences between them. All is forgotten, and Trotsky emerges as the master of his trade in the matter of the triumph of the revolution, whether Stalin wants this or not. Why? Well, the secret is known to the wife of Lenin, Krupchatka. She knows who Trotsky is. In fact, it is she who persuaded Lenin to receive Trotsky. If she had not received him, then Lenin would have remained blocked up in Switzerland, and this alone had been for him a serious reason. In addition, he knew that Trotsky provided the money and helped get the colossal international assistance. A proof of this was a sealed train. So Lenin's wife knew more about this operation than Lenin did.
It's interesting, the question that, you know, the person who shot Lenin, what connections they might have had to this cabal, because getting Lenin out of the way, because, you know, again, his being shot might have led to his subsequent stroke, you know, where he's taken out of commission, and then
right
it sets the stage for the power struggle between Stalin and, you know, Stalin camp and Trotsky camp, where Stalin outmaneuvers Trotsky, which is kind of funny, because if you look at this history, is this is an example, perhaps, where these elites can orchestrate a situation, but they're not completely in control. There's always something they don't foresee, so they have to improvise. And perhaps the rise of Stalin, who was, by all, you know, by any measure, an evil man and a great, you know, monster, a dictator, both the rise of Stalin and Hitler might not have gone the way they expected. Meaning, they expected Trotsky to come in and take over Soviet Russia, and do their bidding in Russia, but Stalin outmaneuvered him. You know, then expelled him. He was exiled and subsequently murdered in Mexico. But then you also have, you talk about the rise of Adolf Hitler and his connections to the same banking elite, and how he was financed by this cabal at first, and he might have gone off script as well.
Right. That's what Rakowski says, that Wall Street signaled and gave financial support to Hitler at a crucial moment. I mean, some people think that maybe Hitler was sponsored from the very beginning, mm-hmm. through Ludendorff and all. I kind of think that Hitler... I'm starting to buy a lot into the so these occultist backing for some of these people. There just seem to be occultists.
The Thule Society and like that, yeah.
Well, I can't quite get my finger on it, because occultism is really a difficult subject to grasp. And if I'm not quite getting it, then probably the average normie isn't either.
Well, it's a big part of Empire, because that's why Aleister Crowley was a British agent. And you kind of need that. And in not to mention the mysticism surrounding, you know, Freemasonry.
Right.
You know, it's sort of a method of creating, I guess, of organizing and also creating group identity. And also, it's often also a diversion.
It's called egregore, where you kind of get people believing a certain theme, and
yeah.
It creates additional power to that theme. That's kind of what occultism
is. I mean, there's particularly like the Satanism that you're talking about, that people by default practice, the Luciferianism that they believe in, of course, is part of Freemasonic doctrine, which is why it's considered a heresy in the Catholic Church, is because of its indifferentism and these things, which again can lead people to believe in sort of what we're seeing today with ecumenicalism, no borders, we're all one people, that sort of thing, you know.
Yeah, it's collective thought
that
has a lot of power, and it just really overwhelms the individual thinker who's thinking independently. And when you apply that kind of collective power, it's just kind of what we're seeing today with stuff.
Yeah, it's also a technology of subversion. Now, I don't know to what extent Freemasonry is operable today, or it's now a sort of a an anachronism or outdated form of technology, a political motivation, because it's been, well, we live in the whole world is a Masonic lodge now. It's been institutionalized. We have institutions which now function the way that, you know, Freemasonry would subvert. I mean, do you really need Freemasonry if you have the National Endowment for Democracy?
Yeah, or CIA? Rockefeller Foundation.
Or right. Foundations or NGOs, which would, today's crisis. Anyway,
my feeling on Hitler, after looking at him a little bit more, I listened to Mein Kampf, mm-hmm. audio version, and yeah, most of it's benign enough, really. I mean, it's not the horrible book that you think it is, but
is
then
he,
all
is,
of a sudden...
Is the reader always yelling?
No, fairly calm. But the thing is
I just never thought Hitler never talked in a calm fashion. He was always yelling, right?
Well, the thing is, he's always talking about the will. He's always talking about the will and my will, and I represent the will, and it's the egregore concept that we're just talking about, which is very occultic, getting people thinking this way for control.
Yeah, I recently interviewed Michael Hoffman about that.
Right, I heard that interview, he might be onto something. I think he may be a little bit early on when Hitler was picked up by these guys, but mm-hmm. I think he's onto something. And I'm not so sure that Hitler deliberately took down Germany, but he was maneuvered into position mm-hmm. to do it. And that's kind of what Rakowski is saying here. I'll just read what he put into it. And then also the other problem with Hitler, he's not a pacifist. It's amazing the guy had gone through the war experience that there's not a pacifist word comes out of his mouth. I defy any of the Hitler didn't do nothing types out there to show me a single word of pacifism in his writings or speech. Educate me. Okay, so he reveals that Wall Street signaled Gabe's financial support in July 29 with a stated motive of restoring balance of power against France and getting Germany back into business economically. At least that's what they told Hitler. It was not revealed to Hitler that Paul Warburg was behind the support, nor did Hitler ask. He just accepted the largesse that put his party over the top. Now, this is important because this is when the Depression is starting, and Hitler was able to finance his guys, his SA and brown shirts, you know, get them through tough times, get them fed and housed.
Yeah, he can give out coffee and donuts when other people can't. Yeah. That's a big part of getting political support. Yeah.
Right. So Rakowski says, in direct negotiations with Hitler, they agreed to the financing of the National Socialist Party and later received, in a couple years, millions of dollars sent in from Wall Street and German financiers through the Freemason shock. He calls him a Freemason. The upkeep of the SA, the SS, and the financing of the elections which took place, which gave Hitler power.
How much shocked is interesting, because he has ties to the Bank of England and also to the Federal Reserve, Benjamin Strong. And I think his middle name, Helmar Hortus Greeley shocked. His father had been in America. So he was in the Anglo fold of these things, and he became the German head of the German bank. So you can see him as a Freemasonic agent within Hitler's fledgling regime at the time.
Interesting. I didn't even know that. That's another. Did everybody catch that out there?
I'm sorry?
All you normies out there catch what he just said?
Oh, awesome. Yeah. And he also was acquitted at Nuremberg, so. Acquitted at Nuremberg.
That's why I love having these conversations with you. add-ons. Anyway, so he said, and Hitler believed it. Rakowski, we do not know, and that was not so important. Whether he did or did not believe our explanation, our aim was to provoke a war, and Hitler was war. Now, do you understand? Every sincere communist imitating his idol Lenin and every great revolutionary strategist must always wish for war. Nothing is so effective in bringing near the victory of revolution as war. It's Marxist-Leninist dogma, which you much preach. The secondary goals of supporting Hitler and a stronger Germany was stoking nationalist flames in Europe and countering Stalin Bonapartism. Hitler in the early years was a Zionist ally, and the Anglo-American Zio bankers had no problem with him putting the Germany's Jewish population in motion and on the move, reinforcing the U.S., Britain, and the early Israel project. Little did they know that Hitler would jettison central bankers. This is what you're talking about. These guys kind of go off the rails sometime. Print his own money and bring Germany back from the brink far too quickly. So this is why I don't exactly think that Hitler was a shill. I kind of reject the pure shill argument, maybe, that Hoffman makes.
Yeah, I think Hoffman makes the point that Hitler's mistake, or it was one thing, is referring to relying on things like the Protocols of Zion, which again, whose origins are questionable, and it's also, there's a lot better research, he says, you can refer to when you're talking about the problem, the Jewish question. That can withstand, scrutiny, but nevertheless they piggybacked on the Protocols of Zion, and also and I think you referred to it in your kind of assessment of Hitler, is Hitler's weakness was his own megalomania, where the best example is that was his crusade into Russia, where more or less that's where he lost the war in the European continent.
Too much of the cultic will.
Yeah, you can will victory, and when the physical, let's look at the physical realities, limitations, the resources you have at your disposal, and the long-term effects. And like you said, at the end of the day, Hitler took the bait. He invaded Poland and gave Britain and France the pretext to declare war on him. And this set the stage for the general war in Europe, this sort of the second phase of the 30 Years' War, which was a longer project to destroy German power and sort of control the continent, which is a long-term Zio-British strategy. is, you know, the Mackinder Doctrine. And Hitler took the bait, and, you know, and then, you know, it was, you know, the rest is history, as they say. That isn't to say that, you know, again, that they're, you know, and then, of course, he's subsequently demonized, and the narrative that spun out of the war, out of its destruction, you can spin multiple narratives out of that war, and it did, and the victors wrote the history of that war, and we're stuck with the narrative today, which supports so much of the power structure, particularly the Jewish power structure in the West, that we're seeing, you know, today, is particularly the Holocaust narrative, and sort of the demonization or the sort of the guilt that's been imposed on the entire world, which is now being used to sort of declare war on Western civilization and also European ethnic groups that
create. Yeah, I mean, the whole thing seems like a project to me. It really does. So he just says Hitler, this uneducated, elementary man, has restored, thanks to his natural intuition, and even against the technical opinion of Schacht, an economic system of very dangerous kind. Being illiterate in all economic theories and being guided only by necessity, he removed, as we had done in the Soviet Union, the private and international capital. That means he took over for himself the privilege of manufacturing money, and not only physical money, but also financial ones. He took over the untouched machinery of falsification and put it to work for the benefit of the state. The 1930s British policy of appeasement was probably designed to encourage Hitler's expansionist tendencies and to provoke war. Douglas Reed, the London Times correspondent in Berlin, was first tipped off to something fishy when his newspaper suppressed his warnings of the Hitler menace. Mm-hmm. This is in January 1938, Rakowski says, quote, "I consider the attack of Hitler on the USSR to be inevitable. Quote, Hitler is impelled towards it by all these capitalist states, which allowed him to rearm and take all the necessary economic and strategical bases. This is quite obvious. The Hitlerist attack on Russia or USSR, in addition, is a dialectic necessity." Now, about the only prediction he missed is he said that that Stalin would be liquidated within a year of the invasion. And actually, it was Rakowski that was liquidated. Mm-hmm. Rakowski advised his interrogator that Western bankers wanted to force a war between Germany and Russia, and that best way of avoiding this was to sign a non-aggression pact with Hitler so to get him tied up in wars with other countries. This suggestion was surprising but made sense, and Stalin adopted it in August 1939. This is me saying this. Incredibly, and then Rakowski says that when the Soviet Union and Germany carve up Poland, Rakowski predicted the democracies would declare war on only one aggressor, and that would be Hitler. This is in January 1938. Pretty amazing book. Mm-hmm. Pretty amazing.
Yeah. So again, the history we're given these events, you know, at best is superficial, but really is misleading because it doesn't expose the true intrigues and power dynamics involved behind these events. As the document says, emperors don't make these decisions. These decisions are made by, you know, the financial power behind these emperors, And through
shadowy characters that you don't hear too much about in history, or kind of footnote characters, and they don't necessarily, you know, they don't necessarily go with the front man. So the people you see out in front, for instance, Trump, for example, he's a straw man for something else going on, or Hillary, or Biden, or whatever's going on with the Democrats, is something shadowy is going on in the background. That's kind of how it relates to our times today, and that's how you have to look at it. An awful lot of Gregory Bateson's,
Double Bind.
An awful lot of Double Bind.
And he also was a master in what they call weaponized anthropology, you know, and that's where you study the culture, perhaps study the weaknesses of a given society, and you exploit them. And he had studied, I think he was in the Pacific during the Second World War, and he studied, you know, how to colonize and dominate primitive people. And of course, the people he represents also looks at the population of the United States and the West as also primitive people who have to be manipulated, constantly manipulated. And that's what the CIA was set up to do with psychological warfare, was to make sure that everything people believe is false.
Not only what they believe, but the choices that they're given are totally false as well. There is no good option.
Yes.
And that's a very strange. That's why everybody seems so demoralized and a lot of black pills. I mean, I have to admit, I get pretty black pilled at times too. You know,
it's you have to understand the people who are ruling over you and what they represent and what their interests are. And we're not given that. I mean, we're given the idea that we have an educational system. Of course, if you refer back to the Reese Committee hearings and how that was taken over to create certain attitudes and beliefs and also to dumb everyone down so they can no longer critically think. There's a war on, you know, on logic and the war on grammar. And if you don't know how to talk, you can't communicate, you can't even think properly. And that's just why they're not stressing those things in school anymore. So you can produce this sort of this, the social justice warrior who's just driven by emotion and pathos. And that's what
One of the things I've noticed in the last couple of years writing, you know, and writing hard for a period of time is that they keep taking away my terms. Your words and terms that you use are all of a sudden used in their narrative.
Yeah.
Leaving you searching around for new terms to try to in run that. And so you're kind of always being caught up in that little game. And then it catches people because people reading your stuff, you know, are kind of going, well, what does that mean? You know, why are you using that term now? You know, because you have to continually reinvent how you communicate.
And what we're confronted with today, because we look at, it's amazing to people because, you know, they were taught a certain narrative of the Russian Revolution or the Second World War or the Cold War. And now 20 years later, the War on Terror. But if you just look beneath the surface, these events are far different than what we were led to believe. And even the people involved, like Al-Qaeda is not the Al-Qaeda, you know, the real Al-Qaeda is very different than the media Al-Qaeda. And the same way that the coronavirus is very different than, you know, COVID-19 is very different than what's really going on. These things are represented. There's certain holograms that are created to the point where they really don't exist as advertised. These are used to manipulate people, to create fear and anxiety. Again, create that double bind dilemma that we all are confronted with the political process. This is why you can't really vote our way out of this situation because the political process isn't designed to deal with it. In fact, it's designed to actually promote it to whatever outcome it's going to serve the outcome of the oligarchs. This isn't the black pill people. It's just to suggest that now you don't look for political figures or leaders to solve this question. You just have to get better educated and break the mind control, the programming, and sort of reject the system. And you can do this. I mean, it's done. From what I understand, that mobs or crowds are formed in Serbia and Albania when the government was floating the idea of a second lockdown, and they stormed the Capitol building, and the government backed down.
And Berlin, you know, Berlin had a pretty good rally, too.
Yeah, you need that type of protest. And unfortunately, when you get down the brass tacks, you're going to need a few examples of these people. I mean, they have to be literally taken by the scruff of the neck and kicked out of office and thrown out a window. Maybe the first floor, so they're not badly hurt, but the optics will be good.
Other thing that's interesting is the hypocrisy. And I'll give you a good example of that. It just really blew my mind. It's when Fauci went to throw the pitch out in the Washington National game. And I made a comment. First of all, his pitch was like a 5-year-old girl. And I asked the question, what real American throws a baseball like that? Yes. Is he even American? So that kind of gets back to my theory of who are these people? They're either un-American or not true Americans. What the hell? Who throws a pitch like that?
Yeah, what Italian-American growing up in Brooklyn doesn't know baseball?
Yeah, or at least, you know, a reasonable throw. I mean, has anybody seen George H.W. Bush, George W. throw a baseball? Excellent. I mean, that guy nailed it. So at any rate, so then he goes up and before he throws the pitch, shows him with his mask down around his neck, which is not how you wear a mask. Mm-hmm. And within 3 or 4 feet of the guy standing next to him, and then another picture of him going out on the field with a mask down around his neck, and then sitting up in the stands with the mask down his neck, right next to two of his friends, with nobody around. I mean, that alone should wake some people up as to the hypocrisy.
Well, the whole thing with recently, Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti announced that he's going to shut off water and power to houses that are hosting large gatherings or parties because of the COVID-19 scare. And he's like, you know, you're threatening people's lives by doing this, these large crowds. And there's a photo and film of him rubbing elbows during a Black Lives Matter protest. He's not wearing a mask, you know. And, well, wait a second. I mean, this clown is out there in a mob, you know, standing shoulder to shoulder with protesters. Now he's lecturing people for having a party, and he threatens to, you know, to shut their power and water off, which I don't think is good for public health nor cleanliness, by the way.
Well, it's just killing the joy of life.
Yes, yeah. But the thing is, it's such a – I mean, just like even to, that idiot in New York, de Blasio. I don't think he's an idiot. I think he's evil. I think he's one of these puppets that are put in to do discordian agent to create mayhem, because that's the only way you can – they're not that stupid. I think they're evil. But he's talking about checkpoints now, asking people, because he wants to impose a 14-day quarantine, anyone coming from as many as 35 states that are considered high incident or something. No constitutional or legal justification for these things. You know, if a policeman stops you, you just say, talk to my lawyer, don't answer any questions. But again, it's all based on this false pandemic scare, which, again, doesn't – there is no – never was, nor there was a pandemic. It was an operation, and the numbers show that. But just weeks.
Well, they're beta testing what they can get away with.
Yeah,
running what I would call a joyless life.
Yeah, but weeks before, people. This guy was rubbing elbows with people who aren't not wearing masks. I see just pictures of this, writing Black Lives Matter on the streets of New York out in front of Trump Tower. Again, more of that dialectic that you know. But if it's so, again, if the pandemic, if the virus is such a threat, they have to shut down economic life, close everything down, shut down culture and social life. You know, you have to shut down churches, but you can have gay pride marches in New York, you know. Then why would you be out there planning Black Lives Matter and engaging in these protests?
Right.
I mean, it's obviously fake. And anyone who can't see that, again, has got to turn the idiot box off and start thinking. I mean, it's just – but it's open there. It's like the governor of Michigan, Whitmore, whatever her name is, her pronouncements. And then there she is at a protest with a mask off, surrounded by people, giving a speech about Black Lives Matter back in June, you know, because that's the second phase. I don't think you can take the subsequent protests and sort of the Antifa and BLM sort of cultural revolution outside the context of COVID-19. I mean, anyone who thinks that's just a coincidence really needs to reevaluate how they look at the world.
Well, again, the 10 is just more double binds. Mm-hmm. And they create the latest double bind is, are you going to have $1 trillion worth of debt or $3 trillion?
Yes.
I mean, that's the choices being given. And I can't watch any of this stuff anymore. I was kind of watching Bloomberg, figuring, maybe I can get a little insight out of Bloomberg. And they just bring these empty suits up to set this double bind narrative.
Yeah, the future is $600 a week relief checks, and no one working, or no one going to church, no one going to weddings, no one going to county fairs, no one going to farmers markets, engaging in commerce, interacting. People not going.
And now they run the goggles.
To me, I think that's a gift.
That one doesn't wake people up.
I think that's a gift. I think there's an idea that eventually God steps in and makes our enemies do something stupid. And I think proposing goggles, I think my goggles and also the perhaps the forced vaccination, I think, was going to.
Well, I mean, the forced vaccination. And first you got Trump talking about. Hinting that the military is going to be handling the
Operation vaccine. Warp Speed. So they use a sci-fi. Yes. I mean, from what I understand, Warp Speed is from Star Trek, right?
Yeah.
So they're using. So this, our scientists are invoking sci-fi language to create this whiz bang, a vaccination. They call it a vaccination. It's more of just a toxic injection to deal with a virus, which, by the official count, is 99.76%. Survival rate. Most people who catch it, whatever it is, are asymptomatic or show mild general symptoms, which goes to the whole problem of this thing actually existing as they say, or even if it does exist, what people have are just general symptoms. It's like general illness. Now come the fall when people get their typical sniffles, and it's going to be worse this year because people have been isolated, because they've proposed and enforced advice which is actually bad for health. Well, surprise, surprise, they've been doing that for decades. So now come the second wave, you know, November, when people start to...
So then when the vaccine, whatever that is, whatever they hammer together, mm-hmm. are you going to be surprised when somebody from the military comes to your door, knocks on your door and says, sir, you didn't go down to your assigned vaccination appointment.
Oh, what they're doing now, I think it doesn't have to be that ham-handed. I think you're ham-fisted. They can now say, you know, you can no longer engage in commerce if you don't have an immunity passport. Or they call it immunity passport. And you have to proof. This is the Gates, you know, Mark of the Beast tattoo. And, and people think you're a conspiracy theorist.
Then they can just run all kinds of stuff off of that. Endless.
Yeah, which is why you have to delegitimize the whole narrative. And this at this point, they've gone so far out on a limb with this whole the pandemic narrative. They can't walk it back without undermining, you know, the legitimacy of the entire system, which it should be undermined because it's at this point it is from top to bottom thoroughly corrupt, as you can see today.
It also seems to me that they want to bring about a revolution.
That's that double bind dialectic you're talking about, yeah.
Well, they're running evictions. You know, people are going to be evicted as as a consequence of their horrible economic decisions.
I would say the offices and the infrastructure of the system doesn't need to be changed. You have to get rid of personnel. I mean, idea of state governments and local governments and county board of supervisors, representatives, and if you were to ask me what reforms in politics, I would say let's go back to electoral college appointed by the state legislatures, have a Senate appointed by the state legislatures, get further away from democracy at the federal level, increase at the local level, and that's how it was originally designed. But I'm saying as far as our Constitution, you know, yeah, it's not perfect, but the problem isn't the Constitution. It isn't the fact that we have representative government. The problem is the spiritual malaise, the corruption of the people, and the fact that we're ruled by satanic reptilian, you know, overlords.
And a centralized power.
Centralized power, yeah. Meaning there's ways you can deal with it. The thing is you don't need a political – what you need is you just need a change of personnel. And they acknowledge that through the decades – you've had people installed to do this very thing, and if
you have a Satanist at a local level, which I think there's a lot of, mm-hmm. you can at least approach them and pressure them.
Yes, yeah, and you know where they live, and people's lives should be made difficult.
More importantly,
I mean that's a good example. There was that doctor, the head of public health out in California, suggested that people need to be taken out of people's homes, and there was an uproar. He got a lot of unpleasant email. So make his life should be made difficult for suggesting that. Same with that idiot, that ghoul Michael Ryan, who works for the World Health Organization, an Irish character out there in Europe, when he suggested taking children from families because they test positive for COVID. His life, wherever he lives, I'm not suggesting anything specific, but when someone suggests something like that, his life should be made very difficult. Protesters should be outside his house. He should not feel comfortable where he lives anymore when you suggest something like that. Because these are the consequences. These people need to feel consequences for their actions. They need to accept responsibility for the policies they've implemented.
But then the protests are given. Then you have a double bind in the protest because they send you down the St. Floyd route on a guy that basically died of a methane fentanyl overdose and heart attack.
Well, this is why you have to be aware of covert warfare and psychological warfare. I don't know if the masses in general are going to understand it because. You know, the masses rely on mass communication. Mass communication is designed for psychological warfare, as you see with today's media. You know, it's a dilemma, and you know, I don't mean to black pill people on it, but the first step in dealing with it is acknowledging the reality of the situation. And you know, unless you confront the reality, you're not going to deal with it effectively. In fact, you'll be manipulated by it. But calling BS on the entire project is the first step, which I think.
First step, but then you have to have competence in terms of how to fight it, and that's a little more difficult.
Yes.
I mean, the only thing I can really come up with is boycotting and not spending money, you know, withhold my money and try to encourage other people to do that, but I don't know if that's enough.
Mm-hmm. You know, and also maintaining your wits and also, staying decent. don't fall under their trap.
But it's hard to stay. It's hard to stay sane when they're taking the joy out of your life because you can really get down. That's the hard part.
Yeah, and that also affects your health. You see, this is the trick. Is this the importance of through it all? trying to find joy in life, and there is still, and also, but the thing is, people have been set up for this, because if you're young, you're isolated, and you've been atomized, you know, because of the way society's been engineered the past 20, 30 years, you have no, nothing to fall back on, right? I mean, if you're a single person, no family or anything, and then you're isolated, I mean, you're very vulnerable to these things.
Right.
You know, but this is why they've shut down the churches, and this is why, you know, you can go to a liquor store and buy a lottery ticket, but you can't go to church and get communion, you know.
Yeah, Trotsky would love this.
Yes.
On that note.
there was a church out in California which violated Governor Newsom's mandate. I wouldn't call it a law, it's a mandate, as if I don't think he's the authority to do this. And there, you know, so the congregation should have went to church. And then there was people protesting this. So wait a second, you're saying going to church is dangerous because you're congregating. Then they show up and congregate outside the church to protest.
They're protesting against these people going to
church? Yeah, I don't know who stirred these. Who would be motivated to do this? Like, why would you go? If you think that going to church is so dangerous, why would you go to a protest?
So they got a bunch of protesters to show up and give these people a hard time. Really?
Yes.
Oh, my God. Oh, that's bad. You know, that's terrible.
Well, but that's, my point, that, again, people have to realize is that these governors, mayors, sheriffs, elected officials who are imposing illegal, unconstitutional mandates and decrees, they've torn apart, they've vitiated their constitutional, obligation. Oh, they've ignored their country obligations. Their only legitimacy is the Constitution they swear to uphold in their office. Once they violate that, they have no legitimacy. You have no obligation to follow their orders or to respect them and, in their official capacity, and they need to be ignored. And the first step to throwing them out of office is ignoring them, because if you don't get compliance with this stuff, it falls. It's a bluff. If no one complies with this stuff, that's why it's a psychological trick. It's the politics of obedience, and people stop complying with it, it just falls away, and they become.
Yeah. Well, I was telling you before we came on the air what's going on here and where I am in Czech mm-hmm. Republic, and everybody complied with the rules when they were out there. That you see the mask mm-hmm. and the social distancing. It was like the whole population was complying, and then they dropped everything for some reason. I don't even know why. I have no idea what the process was. Now things are kind of back to normal, and you'll go out and there's no social distancing. There's no one wearing a mask. It's just like the second they drop the rules, people here in other words, not integrated into their thinking.
Yeah, yeah.
And apparently the United States is just brainwashed a little differently.
Yeah, I mean, it's decades and decades of propaganda, believing that, the medical cartel's propaganda and its interpretation or narrative.
Yeah, here's like, okay, we went along with your rigmarole, we followed your rules, but now you don't have the rules and we're not following. That's how the attitude is here.
Well, here, remember, the lockdown's going to be 14 days, flatten the curve. Now it's defeat the virus, which is absurd. You can't defeat virus. And there's a whole debate about the extent that viruses are even responsible for pathology of disease. Taking the germ theory of Pasteur and bacteria and applied it to viruses, and that's a whole other topic. But the whole point is if you just drill into this, the science behind this stuff is very crude. In fact, it turns up being very mystical and inexact and very crude. So where's the science? Like, a good example is the mask mandates, right? I mean, there's no science behind that. The fact that Fauci himself has not only contradicted himself on television, but also has called it, he said himself, it's a symbol. Well, what's it a symbol for? Of obedience? So what is this?
Obey.
Is this a talisman we have to wear? And so now we have sort of it's been called secular Sharia. The guy who runs David Cullen, who's Computing Forever, a show, he calls it secular Sharia. It's becoming cultural now. In fact, it's applied to men. But I'm saying, and there's been tests. There was a test I just saw on YouTube. Assuming what the guy did was accurate, he took a reader for oxygen in the air, and I guess it has to be, in order for it to be healthy, you need anywhere between 19 or 20 to 21% of the atmosphere has to be oxygen. You have to take that in. And putting on these masks, you reduce it below the OSHA threshold for even acceptable workplace environment. So if you're wearing a mask for any period of time, it's unhealthy, and it actually hurts your health, and actually can bring on symptoms, ironically, that are similar to COVID-19.
You know, the other thing that's going to come, I don't, it's out there. I think a big decline in population from this. I don't think people are going to be reproducing. It doesn't seem to be. You know, I'm talking to my son and his wife. They need to be reproducing. They need to be delivering a grandkid. Well,
this is what war does. And this is another. This is fourth generation warfare, if you will. And if you don't have any optimism or faith in the future, and what that does between people need to be out there working, and having children and family life, and this destroys all that.
Yeah,
you can't even meet people. How do you meet people? Other than Fauci saying, "Do it on Tinder," And not kidding. Someone sent me a link yesterday that University of Georgia recommended that couples wear a face mask during copulation.
Well, even on Tinder, you have to go out and meet people, right?
But I'm saying, really?
What kind of recommendation is that?
Response was, what, do they want handcuffs and whips too? I mean, what are they suggesting?
Oh, I think they want you on Tinder on webcams. That's the idea.
But
the technology, some more business, more spying and more intrusion, and get you kind of used to that kind of stuff.
Well,
so,
again, what they're saying is the mask. Now they're saying the masks don't work. Now you need like respirators and goggles. And that point, you reach the point of obvious absurdity, and that's the whole point. It's to create anxiety, fear, and mayhem. And they've done that. And the point is people still think they can look to health authorities and political authorities to stabilize the situation. What they don't realize is the authorities who have been installed are there to create the mayhem. And that's something that's been, I think, intentional for the last century in the West, with the Tavistock Institute and the scientific study of mass psychology with Edward Bernays, the Walter Lippmann. And this stuff has been written about, and all these people tie back to the various circles that are referred to, like the Rhodes Circle and the British. You think
they're just going to keep running this pandemic nonsense, or come up with something more original?
I think they've, for the time being, it's almost like terrorism. They've set up a narrative where they can keep going with it, because if people still keep buying into the fact that they have to be fearful of, constantly be fearful of germs, when they create a situation where everyone is by default obsessive compulsive. They can do that, and that's what they've done. And now you have people like buying cleaning products, not knowing that the agents in the cleaning products are going to make them sick, especially the way they overuse them. Lysol is still being bought off the shelves. You can't keep up with demand. These idiots are cleaning and spraying everything. They're probably using as breath freshener at this point, because people, again, they buy into this model, and this goes back to it's a weaponized germ theory.
And then you split the population between compliers and non-compliers.
Yeah, that's a whole double bind thing. You get that.
And then you got them, and you got video of them fighting in stores, and so-called Karens approaching somebody and calling each other, using the asshole term a lot.
Again, they've created a society which is crude, demoralized, morally corrupted through popular culture and these things. And then they're set up for this, atomized. You don't get this in a healthy society. You wouldn't get this reaction out of society.
Then you evict them. Then you start evicting millions of people and creating not the Antifa, but some real economic protest. Yeah. And that's where they need. There's where they need Eric Prince in this Operation Condor
and
stuff.
You set up, landlord against tenant. Well, no, the landlord needs to make revenue on his property. The problem is they shut down the economy so people can't work to pay their rent. Not to mention, with the what they've done with the money supply of the banks, and this goes into this with that he talks about what the bankers have done with the manipulation of the money, where they create a usurious system where people can never keep up. It's a rat race, with inflation, that the whole product of inflation is a product of banking, is a product of the banking system, the devaluation of money, which war does, and these things. And look what they're doing now with currency, with this trillions of dollars here and there. Of course, this sets it up again. We're talking about double binds and dialectics. It's been openly talked about by the World Economic Forum with the Great Reset, where this whole thing is they're burning the economy intentionally. They're destroying it intentionally. It's not managing; it's a managed destruction of the economy, so they can create the dialectic, the conditions where you actually beg for universal basic income, digital money, and they lose their independence with money, because now they're just they're. What's been created under the guise of a pandemic, is a social credit system, something of the China model. And now we're all constantly monitored. And that's what these checkpoints are all about, with contact tracing, the idea that you have to go in and provide your ID just to buy something so they can find out where you've been. You have your cell phone carried with you so they can monitor you. This is all as a basis for, becomes the basis for 24/7 monitoring, all under the guise of a false pandemic.
Well, see, here they're actually pushing voluntarily getting an app. So that's what they try to do. They try to get the low-hanging fruit first. Mm-hmm. And then later they can say, hey, you know, we've got X number of people that are doing this. What's your problem? So, you know, conform. And then, and this is kind of a conforming country here. Mm-hmm. And so if you get enough people to do it, then you might get the rest of them to do it. That's how it works here. Because people will ultimately conform if you're tough enough on them. If you're not tough enough on them, they won't conform. Because I think it kind of goes back to the influence of communism, the communist days. There's certain rebelliousness here.
And this is where the economic warfare plays a big part, because through attrition, by waterboarding the economy, keeping it underwater for some time, you kill independent small businesses, which may not be on board, where corporations like Walmart or Amazon, they're all through interlocking directors. And again, the whole function or method of interlocking directors is control, and that's what was exposed in the risk meetings with the different foundations.
Where you and isn't it interesting, the same companies are the ones that are giving out the big bucks to Black Lives Matter.
Yes.
What a coinky thing. Those are the ones you got to boycott, people. Mm-hmm. You know, try to help your local people, even if you've got to pay a few extra bucks, you know, to completely change your whole model of shopping, where you get your services from. And get away from these big box tyrants
that are running. Yeah, they hate you and your family.
That's right. They don't. They do. So
you know, and that, that's what it's. So they've created, you know, through the corporate model, they can implement much of this not through state mandates or laws. They can through human resource policies and corporate policies. Like the mask mandates isn't directly the state. It is an advisory by the governors. Then the governors and mayors then threaten local businesses with pulling the license of these businesses if they don't impose the mandate. Now, that's still, if you go into local independent shops, people are ambivalent. It's the big box stores that try to enforce this stuff. Recently, they've relented because it's even affected their bottom line. People aren't going shopping anymore, which is a whole function of creating, destroying brick and mortar and creating everything online, which is why Jeff Bezos, who owns the Washington Post, is constantly, the paper that he owns is always hyping the pandemic fear, because this supports the Amazon model, you know, which has ties back to the deep state. Same with
and then in the background and all this stuff, you have Trump, who's just he's the most half-assed guy ever. He's just, everything's half-assed.
Yes. Yeah.
He takes no real leadership role other than, you know, occasionally he'll critique somebody and take little shots at him and make his Trump-tard followers think that he's going to do something, and then constantly disappoints them, and you just keep moving down this road of nothing, nothing positive to develop.
Yeah, false. Who presented Fauci to him as the guy, the go-to guy in this stuff, despite Fauci's record, you know, with AZT and the fraud at NIH, which was easily, you know, researchable and found out. Same with relying on Neil Ferguson.
Yeah. Like Trump, why did you present this particular double bind again? Yeah. Exactly.
You know, now you're defending
the conservative route on fiscal insanity as being, oh, we're only going to do $1 billion and $400 and give, you know, and just creating it. Shit storms out of that. It's just incredible.
Well, it's the Imperial College of London with Neil Ferguson, his study, his computer modeling, which predicted millions dead in the United States, hundreds of thousands dead in the UK. Well, that's pretty bad. And you think whether it's 10 Downing Street or the White House, and someone suggests that we have this guy here at Imperial College of London, he has a study, says this can happen unless we lock down. The first reaction, okay, who is this guy? What's his record? Oh, he's wrong about everything. So why take his advice? You know, they're not that stupid. You know, it turns out that, you know, the Imperial College of London is tied into the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Gavi, the World Health Organization, the various institutes that advise the governors of the United States to lock down their economies, all tie back to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. So you have a network, an octopus, if you will, that implemented this stuff. Of course, this ties back into the Event 201 back in October, which tabletop this very event. They gamed it. They war-gamed it. They foresaw it. You have the Rockefeller Foundation, the lockstep document back in 2010. So this stuff has been long in planning. It's a crisis waiting to happen, and it was a crisis that was created. And what's amazing to me is just how holographic it is, meaning that there's no there, meaning that there is no, yeah, people are dying, people die every day of these things. And, you know, if you look at communicable diseases, even by the official numbers, COVID-19 is a piker compared to tuberculosis and other diseases like cancer. And, you know, like I said, we have a disease which globally has a 99.76 death rate, and they're shutting down the economy. No, there's another agenda here. You know,
well, then when Fauci proposed goggles, the first thing that comes to my mind is which one of his pals owns the goggle industry. It's just automatically corruption with me every time.
Yeah, what gets me is like people really accept this. I mean, masks. I thought masks were ridiculous. You know, and they are.
It's getting so bad that I say to, you know, my sidekick Torchy, I said, "Oh, come on, we're gonna have to write a post on goggle manufacturers." Please.
I did see a guy riding.
Don't make me have to look into this. You know.
I did see a guy riding a bicycle the other day wearing a respirator on. Now, this is something you put on when you're spraying, you know, insecticide or something, pesticides. It's not something you know, aerosolized pesticides. Yeah.
Well, but, no, the trick they might pull on us, though, is they might come up with some bioterror that's a little bit nastier.
Oh, yeah, that's always a chance. Now, I think it's tougher than they say because viruses act like viruses. And I don't think they can engineer them the way they claim to engineer them. And that's sort of a meme they put out with the media with movies, right? The bioweapon release. And so it's never really played out. And so I kind of optimistically think they really can't do it because they don't know how it reacts. One thing is viruses are dynamic. They change. And there is some question of whether or not how pathological they are. There's real scientific debate on that. There's also people's immune systems are dynamic, you know. And so it isn't like automatic. But if you can create the hologram of a pandemic, why bother? And they did that with the media. When they locked everything down back in March, they created the effect, which in the eyes of many people proved the cause. Because their reality is the box, is the screen they watch. And the media.
But they do have the ability. They do have the ability for hard kills.
I think with 5G or some sort of weapon.
Right.
Yeah,
So then all of a sudden you get all of us that are resisting the mask and all that and start dying in mass, and then they'll go, ha ha.
I told you.
Rubbing their lizard lips together. Yeah. And we gotcha.
Or they create an economic depression where people can't eat right, so their immune systems suffer and they get sick anyway. Or the anxiety and fear, you know, exposure. You know, a good example is Robert Redfield, the current head of the CDC. Kind of said, well, you know, deaths from despair now outnumber COVID victims. Well, who could have predicted that? I mean, the country was already on the, you know, was already psychologically comorbid to begin with.
Has Redford been fired yet?
No, he's failed upward like Fauci, you know.
Okay, so he's okay.
But that's our cacistocracy. It's what this document kind of reveals, right? I mean, this is what this. Sort of the Red Symphony kind of reveal how it works is you install all the worst people.
So what's the motto of your stroke? May you live in interesting times. Isn't that what you?
Yeah, that's what it was named after. Unfortunately, yeah, we have a. So they make it very interesting. Yes. Yeah, so okay, Russ. Well, I want to thank you for coming on the show.
Okay, thank you, Tim. Enjoyed it as always.
So go check out Red Symphony, the review of that, and also some of the other related articles, which kind of all relate because they're all talk about the sort of this cacistocracy, this elite, if you will, crime syndicate, as you, I think, accurately referred to, because it is a syndicate manipulating the world and just creating mayhem so they can make money off people's suffering because it's all about extraction. And I think ultimately it is a Satanist Luciferian doctrine, which they'd rather rule in hell than serve in heaven, you know. So
yep, okay.
And it's rushwinter.net, right?
Winterwatch.net.
I'm sorry, yeah, winterwatch.net, yeah.
Okay,
great. Well, listen, enjoy the rest of the day, and I'll be in touch.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.